What's up? This is KYT, and I'm joined here by special guest Alexander Hain, and we're doing the Table for Two podcast. What's it up, Alex?
Very good, very good.
Oh, wait, sorry, I got my role reversed. Yeah. Hey, I'm Alexander Hain, and here with Karyung Tom, the man, the myth, the legend, the Arena Super Cup champion.
Former. I've got to shout you out. We got a coffee that said, like, someone donated us two coffees, but usually it's one for each of us, me for editing, you for being the star of the show. But this guy specifically says he hopes both coffees go to you because of the amazing intro you did last.
So I should grab this coffee you're having right here.
yeah. This coffee actually belongs to you.
I'm enjoying mine one. Quite nice. Avenue G. One of our places where we record this.
Because the original place.
Yeah, it's the first episode was recorded here, and this is where we go, I guess, when neither of us have that much time to meet up. Not time to have a full feast, courtesy of you.
I do want to shout out everyone who gave feedback for the last episode. Matt Berling said it was one of the best podcasts, magic podcasts he's ever listened to. And while editing it, I didn't feel great about it because of the... We were in that, like, complex Desjardins, or we were in that mall area where there were random, like, kids shouting, and there was, like, this echo that annoyed me. So I think part of the future coffee, I would invest in a lavalier microphone or whatever so that people can hear you and your infinite wisdom in, like, high quality. I think it deserves to be heard.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But, you know, I mean, we always know this podcast is about the quality, not about the presentation. It's kind of the opposite of a lot of the magic content out there, which is really, you know, often very clickbaity, I find. Like, stuff like some of the main websites, they're just moving in a different direction. And, you know, it used to be that I would, like, a site like Channel Fireball, for example, I would check, you know, every couple of days to see what new articles there were. Was there something important? And now, if I check it once a week, I'm still disappointed, kind of, in terms of content that I feel that I'm going to gain from. Like, there's a lot of videos. There's a lot of more focus on casual content. And a lot of kind of just deck breakdowns, sort of. And... You know, it makes sense. If I was Channel Fireball, if I'm Star City or something, you know, my goal is to sell a bunch of Magic cards. So I want my writers posting headlines that bring people in and then having content that makes them want to buy cards. You don't actually care about anything other than how much your articles drive traffic of people who are buying stuff, right, to your site.
I don't know, it's just... It's interesting. I mean, I used to be a psycho net decker. I would be at midnight when SCG was releasing them at midnight. I'd be like refreshing like crazy. But you bring a good point. I think it's something like, as a kid growing up, we see artists in movies or whatever complain that they're selling out, right? They're not showing their true vision.
But it's hard because, you know, if you're a magic content creator, there's not that many avenues you actually have to make money from what you do. And I'm lucky enough that I'm in the MPL, and, you know, I've done pretty well as a pro for the last few years that I have. Like, I'm relatively stable financially. I'm, you know, if I don't get a source of income tomorrow, I'm gonna be fine a year or 2 years down the road. But not everybody is like that, and some people, you know, are really living paycheck to paycheck. And while kind of the digital age of magic has opened up more avenues, I don't think ultimately a lot of them are healthy. Like, you see, there's tons of Patreons out there, but how many people can really get supported? How many, you know, podcasts can make people money? How many, you know, independent articles? You see, the made websites are kind of tightening their belts, right? It seems like with Kevin Jones and Tom Ross leaving, getting let go from Star City, and then PV and Siggy and Ben S from Channel, and. Yeah, I mean, you know, see recent things like discussion on Twitter of how if you want to be a streamer and you really want to make it, you often end up working yourself to death doing like 15 hours a day every day, you know, just because anytime you're not there, your viewership numbers fall and you just aren't making money. You kind of have to always be on.
It's a competition.
Yeah, it's... You know, it used to be that just the competitive side of magic was a competition, but now the content side is too, and it's rough because, you know, in any competition, there's some people left behind who are the losers. And these are a lot of really intelligent, talented people, and, you know, that have devoted a lot of their time and effort into Magic. And, you know, it's hard to decide that you're, you know, to going to do something else that rewards your effort and dedication, and just figure what that thing is. Just, and often you know, to do something else, you're going to have to go and get an education or start off from like ground zero, where in Magic you already like at least in the halfway point. And you know, if you don't have the money to be able to do that, to take that kind of break off, you're kind of really screwed.
I still remember when I first started watching streaming, AJ Soccer was one of the main streamers. I just feel like if we randomly restarted now, it would just be like, to try to be one of the top, it'd be a long struggle, just because breaks hurt you. But it's nice to observe all this happening, all these people building their Patreons. But I've seen people, like a Twitter account today, I read a comment that like, at this point, there's just like too many Patreons that he wants to donate to, and it becomes overbearing for some of these fans that want to support everyone, but wishes that it was like a membership, like SCG Premium, where it's like you pay one fee and get to support a bunch of people. So that part is interesting, because there's at least, I mean, at this point, there's like over 1,000 people that, you know, I'd love to support if I was still part of consuming that competitive content. There's just, or not, or some people not necessarily competitive.
Yeah, I mean, I gotta give the shout out to my, as you call them, my boys, the Czech House, Andrei Strasky, Ivan Flock, and Stanislav Sivka, who are, they're making their own site content, and I think that's awesome. Like, I had, you know, you and I've toyed with the idea of having like a content site, but you know, you have to get enough people on board so you have a steady stream of content. And you know, that's going to be the challenge for them, I think. But you know, groups like the Lotus Box, for example, they, you know, when you have enough people, you can actually accomplish something like that for them. You know, Lotus Box, they just have their Patreon, I think, but a lot of people have had some success with their deck list there. And you know, it's not something that I'm interested in, not the type of content that I like, but you know, everybody has fun value where they can, and certainly a lot of people, you know, want to take the shortcut kind of and pay a few bucks and get a deck list that people have put a lot of work into. And, you know, it's a great resource that it exists.
Let's jump into it'll just be interesting to see how this evolves, and I'm sure we'll comment on this, like, in another few episodes, how it's progressed for a lot of, because it's just pretty recent, the whole CFB and SCG letting go writers, contributors, and it'll be interesting how it plays out for me. But
yeah, I mean, we're gonna see what the future of Magic content is. It, in my opinion, it seems like it's, from, you know, where I'm standing, from my limited perspective of the history of Magic content, from when I would watch and read it to now, is that it feels hugely like it's gone downhill, and the actual resources to get better at Magic are becoming fewer and fewer.
Yeah, I mean, it's caused Matt Sperling to start his own YouTube channel.
Yeah.
For advanced players.
No, his videos are great. Like, I think that, you know, I've always been a fan of Matt Sperling's content, you know, mostly like his humorous stuff, but I think he's, you know, he's been doing a really good job with that stuff, and I'm not only saying that because he shouted out us on Twitter, but I guess I am somewhat saying it because I think he's listening, so shout out to Matt. But I think it's harder and harder, because I think a lot of people who are making that type of content, like us, we're not really getting any financial benefit from it.
Right.
And I think that's because the money in Magic comes from the buying and selling of cards. These retailers are making tons of money. You know, you work for one. Like, that's where the real money is in Magic, you know, not in playing, not in making content, but it's in buying and selling cards. And so the content producers are usually paid via the card sellers. And that kind of creates some perverse incentives where, you know, there's no restrictions on Magic stuff. And so, you know, there's more and more incentive to just be producing stuff that gets people to buy stuff. I feel like we're not quite at the point of, like, if you've seen the movie Wolf on Wall Street, where, like, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is trying to sell all these penny stocks, you know, all this crap, and he's just, you know, I feel like we're moving in the direction that, like, articles are becoming like that, you know, articles and videos are just like, hey, check out this thing, oh, that looks so cool, I love playing, watching Mengucci play, like, Garbage Legacy deck number 4, and I really have to buy all those cards, where am I going to get them? Well, what website are you watching this video on, you know? And, you know, it's fine. Not everybody wants to get better at Magic, but I think a lot of people do, and they do visit these sites to find deck lists which they think are going to make them better, you know, or at least make them have a better chance at the upcoming tournament. But it's just a quick fix, and, you know, ultimately I think a lot of people don't really know the questions that they need to ask to get better, and without content out there kind of showing them the way, it's very easy to become stagnant. It's like, I think, you know, John Finkel once said that Magic Online, for playing Magic Online, you can become a good player from playing a lot of Magic Online, but you can never become a great player. And that's because most of your opponents would be, you know, between bad and good players. Rarely would you play against other great players. To become a great player, you do have to play against other great players and understand how they think and kind of to make those plays that are, like, next level, that are based on the fact that you're not just playing a bunch of pieces, you're playing a human being, and that they are also controlling pieces, and you can influence their decisions through what you do. I said a lot there, so you gotta find something to hook on to.
There's a few things. Like, there's one thing that we want to talk about. I guess we can jump into that now, but... yeah, thinking about what you said, I do want to live in a world where, like, someone's full-time job could actually be strategy content production, and their focus would just be to make that strategy, and there'd be enough demand for that. But I mean, like, we're doing this now just because, like, we just like hang out together and then eating food or drinking and then just recording, and we're like, why not just have people.
You can't forget the warm fuzzies that we get.
The warm fuzzies. So that's why Andy Football Peter says, like, he loves the show because it's like, it's as if they're sort of sitting next to us, and we're just like having. And that's why it wouldn't work over Skype or anything, or it would be too. It might work because we're such good friends, but, like, it would lose that casual feel that just naturally happens because we meet in real life.
I think our show wouldn't work over Skype or something. If I make a Patreon, definitely going to have, like, a top elite tier where someone, like, can pay a bunch of money to come and have dinner and hang out with us. Don't worry. You can pay for only my dinner.
Okay. At some point, you want to do ask maybe what questions to ask or what are good questions. But I want to do this first. Tyler Nightingale, huge fan of yours, I imagine. Wanted to ask, and we've touched upon this topic about, like, what we think WotC should do or other people can do to, I guess, increase the branding or add the personality to the game. And this is a topic that I'm always curious about. I'm always curious, and that brings good answers from you. For example, like game design, I'm always curious what makes it good, and it allowed me to ask all these questions for you to answer that people love. And even some current game designers are like, wow, they loved our last episode or the last two episodes that talked about that. And I'm always interested in the marketing from other games and this game and what they could do. And I've always said, I'll start first. I always said, like, we've seen them do some good stuff, but we don't know their budget. Like, we've seen them do those, like, quick voice clips at the MCs or at the championships of different NPL members or invitees where they are able to show a bit of their personalities. I think I was listening to Huey talk about a recent trip of his or whatever, but then I see stuff like, but this is super low cost. The Twitter questions, like, one of their Twitter was like showing the 5 hype songs that 5 different invitees to this championship listen to get hyped, and it's like, it's super low cost, but it's also super low impact. Does not really attack, especially if it's a song I don't know, and even if it is, it's like, doesn't tell me much. And then I'll end by this, and type of content that I wish they did more. And BDM told me, like, at one point he did a piece or some content with you about your battle with depression that never got released. And then we released your personal piece on insanemtg.com, and that probably showed more of your personality, gained you more fans from people who sort of knew you, and then people who sort of already knew you a bit from your playing skill, they got to know more about you personally, to connect with you, and have a reason to cheer for you. And it's like, why, I don't know, like, they could do more pieces like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, okay, again, there's a lot to digest there.
My turn.
But, yeah, but certainly on the last point, I think that they did a bunch of interviews with people, and I think that they're not sure that they necessarily want to release them all, you know. I think part of it, you know, you talked about budget, and I think that, I don't know what their budget is, but I do know that it's just not enough. They have, you know, the idea to make Magic and do an esports is an ambitious undertaking. You know, they have a successful tabletop game that they've had for a long time, but they're trying to change into something else, right? Make it much more of a viewer-friendly experience rather than a player-friendly experience, and to, you know, move into the digital realm and this stuff, and like market players rather than cards. And this is a huge shift from what they've been doing for, you know, the past 25 years. You see the blowback when they stopped following Grand Prix, you know, having coverage for that. And they're, you know, from their perspective, oh, we're an esport now, this is like the amateur leagues. But, you know, not everybody, like that, the view of the public hadn't adjusted to what their internal view was yet, and still hasn't. And you know, that's because they're kind of trying to do this huge undertaking with a small budget. And I think a lot of the employees of Wizards that I interact with, or that, you know, the public interacts with and who are working there, are hugely dedicated. They're fans of Magic. They're fans of pro Magic. They want this to succeed. They love the game. And, you know, the passion there is often really noticeable. But so often I just feel like their hands are tied by, you know, whatever higher up is saying they can't do this because usually, you know, budget, because there's only so much money. And it's sad to me because I think, you know, I think that there is potential for Magic in this area, despite what people say. You know, some people are very, oh, Magic was never going to be an esport, just stick to what you're good at. But I think it could be it requires so much more of an investment, so much more effort, and frankly, they just haven't put that in. The fact that how many people can name everyone in the MPL, it should be like anybody who plays a PTQ should be able to name everybody on the MPL, right? Whereas, like, and you look at, these things that they do as promotion, these, like, five players, how many of those have you seen with like, actual MPL members? It's just the challengers that they're promoting mostly. And then they do a little video with whoever wins the MPL weeklies. Like, I've never been asked what my hype-up song is by any interview. In fact, you know, talking about asking bad questions, every single time, what would this winning this tournament mean to you, is asked. Every time, without fail. Or like, you know, oh, what does it mean to be a professional Magic player, or whatever. Like, you know, it means that I get a paycheck for doing this, you know. What did winning this tournament mean? My favorite was when Ben Stark said, this is, you know, about like, $40,000 and 30 pro points or something, you know. And, you know, that's not quite the reality. There, you know, we all have an emotional attachment to this, but, you know, the fact that you get asked the same questions that kind of don't actually delve into who you are, like, so much of how Wizards like to paint everybody's identity is, like, by what decks they play or what format they prefer. Like, Ben Stark, the first thing you ever think about him is he loves Limited, right?
Yeah.
It's the first thing. Shout out to Ben Stark, by the way. We might get delve into him further if we talk about the pinnacle sports. We got to talk about that. But yeah, I mean, you know, or you talk about Craig Wesco. He loves White Weenie, right? Well, again, we've talked many times. Both of these people are interesting human beings who have a lot of stuff. You know, you get to see Ben's been streaming lately. And you get to see a bit of him beyond the robotic exterior. You get to see the robotic interior as well. But you know, like, there's a lot to show there. Someone like Huey, you know, who's been around, a lot of people think, oh, he's like the best Magic player. Well, he's, you know, he's a brilliant guy, and he's got a lot of interesting stuff to him as well. It's not really my place to say. You mentioned with me, for instance, my struggles with depression that I wrote about on the blog that we partly host this podcast on.
SaneMTG.com.
Yeah, if you want to check it out. And yeah, I mean, you know, that was difficult to write. I didn't really write it with the purpose of garnering more fans. I, in fact, thought I maybe would lose some fans for that, but the outpouring of support was huge. Got a lot of DMs on Twitter, which I opened up. Some from people I never knew before, and who thanked me for making them not feel alone with that struggle, and also from a lot of people who I did know. And you'd be surprised how many people and how many names of people you look up to who are like, yeah, I've experienced similar stuff like this. And it's I do think that magic is selects for these types of people often, especially professional magic. And I've even gotten some outside interest from organizations, so potentially going to have some other stuff pop up from that. But the purpose of that was really because I thought there was the potential to help people, and I'm glad that it kind of did. And I didn't go anywhere near as deep as I did on that post with my interview with BDM. I kind of just, it was a PG-rated version, kind of, But still, I think Wizards didn't think it was good enough to post because they don't want those associations. They want everything to be candy-coated. The magic world, however, is a real world, and there's a variety of people with a variety of problems. And look, they make their posts about check out this thing. Who's going to get to stay in the MPL? It's exciting. Who's going to be crowned a champion? Which challenger is going to go to Worlds? And it's like, well, meanwhile, I'm in there and talking to other MPL players, and majority of the feeling is like they're all incredibly miserable. They're burnt out from having way too many important tournaments to test for this year, and the pressure of this coming tournament that really, if you do well in this tournament, which is largely decided by variants, you get to have a job next year. If you do not, you're fired. Good luck. There's no, the chance of you coming back up, slim. And, it's like, some of these things are like, could be determined even by just in the system who gets a buy based on the software or whatever. Like, the last Pro Tour, Andrew Cuneo got a round one bye and he ended up making top eight. Not to say that everybody who gets a round one bye makes top eight, but it's just funny, that these things happen. And it's certainly not to take away from him because he's a brilliant Magic player, but it's very stressful. And whenever you're kind of playing with people's lives for other people's entertainment. There is, the puppet symbols came with it. it's certainly, Daniel Fournier on Twitter said, oh, he loves to see it. It's his favorite stuff. He says, I can get that. I mean, you have to have some kind of relegation, right? But, in the old system, the gaps kind of between top and middle pro and stuff were more fluid. At least, if you were gold, if you were still qualified for all the tournaments. Now, if you're in Rivals, you're qualified for the regional Pro Tours, which basically with Wizards announcements are like the equivalent of being silver, kind of would qualify for all of those. They're adding more and more ways to qualify, kind of, which is good because a lot of people get to engage with pro level Magic. But on the other hand, if you're in Rivals, you're not really at the full level of pro Magic. You're kind of on the outside looking in a little bit. It's a lot. I mean, on Twitter, right, Dave Rude asked, how did I prepare for this tournament with this extra pressure? And for me, I try and keep the perspective that I focus on the things that I can control. And what I could control is I prepared for this tournament, I submitted a deck that I think is pretty good, and Esper Control, by the way, it's not public yet.
Damn it, Shaheen's going to be happy.
It's probably not quite Shaheen's version of Esper Control, though, but it's maybe more Esper mid-range. Okay. I don't know. It's a kind of, in some ways, an engine deck with Kenrith and Bolas's Citadel.
Ooh.
I'll you can cast a lot of spells that with that. So you're just kind of trying to go over the top in that way. But
yeah, did you prepare differently? You feel mentally?
Well, I think a lot of my preparation has been different, more because of where I am at with my mental health. In the past, something like this would spiral me down. It would be a very negative experience. Often before deck submission pro tours, I feel awful. And this time, actually, I didn't feel awful. I submitted my deck before the deadline, you know, not by a huge amount, but, and I felt okay. You know, I accept that what happened is not really within my control. You know, if I've done what I think is, you know, you could always do more preparation. You can always put more work in, but I put in what I think is a reasonable amount of work, and I came up with something that I think is pretty solid. I feel pretty well prepared. Could I be more prepared? Am I the most prepared person? Did I put in the most work? Absolutely not. No. But I never really am. And often I convince myself that, oh, it's not worth really putting in any effort if I'm not going to be the most prepared. And that's, of course, a trap. But so I've done my part. Now I'm going to go to the tournament. I'm going to try and play my best, you know, and if I make a mistake, I'm not going to beat myself up about it. It's not like I'm going to be making mistakes on purpose. And if I get unlucky and lose, then I get unlucky and lose. If I get, you know, average luck and lose or whatever, and because I screw up, then that's what happens. If I get lucky and I win, then that's great. But it's not fully within my control. And the part that I do control, that's what I focus on. And I'm trying to feel happy by the fact that I did what I can do and I did it well. And with that being my goal, rather than any performance of the tournament, my mental state's a lot better, I think. And kind of in the last few days after deck submission, I've been not really playing much Magic. Kind of taking a break from it.
Okay. Man, we just had too many things to cover, because we have to bring it back to the Tyler Nightingale question.
And oh, yeah. Shout out to Tyler Nightingale.
Comment on, you're right, like when I think about, let's say, why people would want to follow Tom Ross, it's because he's known as the weird deck guy, the infect guy. He's known as, you know, the guy that plays usually these off the wall decks, and that's become people's brand instead of like the piece. Like, obviously we didn't intend for it to boost. We just posted it on a site that, you know, we just randomly created for the podcast, not associated with any store or whatever, and it was just there. And but that allowed people to see like a non deck building, non playing related personality part of you, and I don't know what they could do. I mean, I've seen, as you know, I've been obsessed with a lot of League of Legends and even Valve, Riot, both of them, and how they do their videos or their documentaries. And then I watch the recent clips done by, I believe they're still done by Athena. They're great, highly well produced, good footage. But I think maybe she's been asked by Watsi to keep them really short, so they seem to be like at 2x speed, and you basically get a cool clip with cool music, but of like three people saying one lot, like random quotes about that player, like Redu, he's a solid player, from like someone else, and then it shifts to another guy to have your Dominguez. And it's like that type of stuff is not as good as what Ryan Valve are doing, where I feel like I said in Dota, after watching the True Sight documentary that I recommend to you, like I feel emotionally invested in the team that won the last two world championships or the international in OG, and I know who they are, and I feel invested in them if I follow their, like if they battle out for the upcoming world champs, I'm just going to be following them. So
yeah, I mean, I think League does a pretty good job about this stuff. I don't really follow Dota, though. You told me there's a movie I should watch. True Sight. All right, I'll have to download it for my flight. But I mean, you know, the player's identity isn't this guy's a mid laner, right? You know, even like a lot of Faker's thing is that he is actually super devoted to League, right? In an interview, he's like, oh, no time for a girlfriend or whatever. I have to win Worlds or whatever, you know. But a lot of other players, it's not, still not entirely it. You get to see the people. Like, there's some video that's just like, was, I think, like, two guys basically just from different teams just meeting and having like lunch or whatever at a restaurant and just chatting with each other. And just like I watched it, I'm like, this is cool. Like now suddenly I like feel more emotionally invested in these players. Like I'm gonna watch them in the future. I care how they do because they've been humanized. Right. And they don't really, you know.
Did you watch the Brad Nelson Cribs thing or whatever they did?
I did not, no. I mean, a lot of this, the Magic stuff, first of all, airs during PTs where I'm playing. But also, I kind of already know, I know a lot of these people. But it's not, you know, Brad is someone who I think has been reasonably, you know, publicized. He's someone that people can feel that they have a bit of a connection with. And that's partly, like, him doing his own stuff. Someone like Mengucci, too, I think, you know, has at least the Mengucci cuisine. And he's, you know, he loves to play Legacy and stuff. And he also is just so devoted to Magic, kind of, you know, that you get to see that, too. But, and definitely, you know, some of it is our own fault as pros, not necessarily, like, promoting ourselves that much. But I do think that there's a lot more that Wizards could do, and the fact that, you know, they have full articles on various people, but they don't really do it on MPL players, and, you know, someone like Jean-Emmanuel Desprats, who, you know, they finally put, like, an article on him after he qualifies for Worlds, and they have interviews, like, they interviewed me in the last Pro Tour about, like, around five people, two of whom I told them, and they're like, oh, we're still gonna do it, I just don't really know at all, and they're just asking me questions about them. I'm like, you know, What do they expect? Like, do you think it's going to come out with high quality stuff that's going to make people really invested in this person?
Oh, they're using those for the trailer. Those promo clips, right? If you see something good about them, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know where to use things, but I mean, I felt like, you know, connected somewhat to players when they have things outside of just the Magic. Like, I remember this is my second ever Pro Tour was Worlds 2011. It was an old world, so, like, not a tiny thing. And a bunch of players were being inducted in the Hall of Fame. One was Shuhei, and I remember there's one of the things in his induction ceremony was, or public thing, or at least, was a video where Martin Jews was being interviewed, and he was telling a story of they're, like, in Florida, and there's a crocodile there, or whatever, or alligator. I forget which one is supposed to be in Florida. Apologies for people who really care. It's like GIF or GIF, you know. But and Shuhei's like trying to get a picture with it, you know, and he's like coming up closer, and then he just starts like petting it, and you know, it's like they're like, is this real? And he's like, they're like, I don't know, is it just plastic? And he goes, he's like, nice little thing, you know. He's petting the thing, and they're like, holy crap, Shuhei, get away from that, like, you know. And it turns out it was real or whatever, and he was fine. But it's just like that. You know, I feel like you learn a little bit about someone, you feel more connected to them, and I think feeling that sense of connection is important, more than just, like, you get some connection from, like, oh, this person, oh, Ivan Falk always plays Control Decks or whatever, I love Control Decks too, but it's more than just that, right?
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I gained from, like, the watching the Dota thing was even though it was just based off them playing, I learned their personality. Basically, there's five of them, but one of them is, like, clearly the motivational speaking guy or pseudo captain of the team. Another guy's just, like, really quiet. That reminds me of me, of course, if we were playing the game five. And then, you know, they each were able to, you could see what type of player they were and how I could relate to each of them in a different way. So I like that too. I mean, it doesn't have to necessarily. So I just realized it doesn't have to be outside of the game, but it just it has to be something I guess I could feel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they even really. They used to, I think, have like audio for players in feature matches, right? Back in the day, they got rid of that. You know, I can understand why in some ways, but and then there's things talks about people, you know, showing emotion or not showing emotion after they win, and. There's certainly a bit of a culture of, like, not trying to, being really cautious of your opponent, you know, the stuff like the what I guess I could call the good game culture, where you can't say good game if you're the one who won, you know, you have to wait for the loser to say it or to offer the handshake. And coming from a chess background, it seems ridiculous to me. You know, you just you say good game. It's just sport, common sportsmanship. But in Magic, it's so much of this connotation of like, oh, it wasn't really a good game. It was a bad game. I got mana screwed, or like, you know, and no, you know, it's a game you're playing. Did the other person cheat you? You know, no, they didn't cheat you. You can opt for the handshake, and you can be happy when you won. But one of the things is that, like, I think kind of going into, you know, the Heart of Stone from one of Patrick Rothfuss's Name of the Wind series, I can call it. And the Heart of Stone is like where you know, you're very logical and rational, and you kind of remove your emotions a bit. Helps sometimes when you're playing Magic, you know, to make just the most correct decisions. You kind of become like a Vulcan, right? A person of pure logic. And then suddenly you win, and then you have to get out. You have to first change out of that like mode into back to human mode in some ways. That's why if you watch me play, I always look really serious and focused, and that's a strength of mine that I'm able to focus like that. But also, you know, when I won Barcelona, for example, I'm just like slowly gathering in my permanents and putting them in. Like, yeah. You know, people are like, why do you de-sideboard after they win? It's like, because they're still in like the mode of don't let your, like, put your heart on your sleeve. Because also, when you and you show your emotions while you're playing, you give away information. Like you mentioned, when in the finals of GP Montreal, where I was drawing land after land after land, and, you know, my opponent doesn't know because just, you know, not, I'm not giving that away. Whereas some, you know, a beginning player could just be like, just like counting how many lands they have on the board. That's my favorite. My opponent counts how many lands they haven't played, and then like look to their graveyard, counts them, and just like, you know, look to their hand and like count those. And it's like, okay, well, I know exactly what you have. And like, you're just basically complaining, but not like subtly to me, but as well to yourself. And, you know, that does no one any good.
In Barcelona, it was hilarious because after you won, they were like showering you with shit, like check. Your Rookie of the Year award. They're just getting,
yeah. Somebody basically came out with like one of those things that they use in the subways in Japan to push people in, and they just yanked Godenis out of the way, and then just, you know, like confetti starts falling from the ground. They come out with a big check, a trophy, and like a plaque, and they just hand them to me while I'm like still holding my deck box and I'm just trying to balance them. Meanwhile, a bunch of Canadians are coming out and singing Hallelujah, and, you know, off tune, obviously. And I'm just like, what is going on? Where am I? Am I awake? Is this a dream? You know, and you know, it didn't process for a while. I know, talking to Andre Strasky, who one of the people who says our podcast is the best podcast, though, you know, he also wanted you fired. But no, I'm kidding. He loves you. He also said, hey, why are you calling me out like that, Alex? But he also said it took him a while for it to kind of process. Because, you know, really for anybody who's taking competitive Magic seriously to the point where, you know, you're going to attend multiple Pro Tours, like, winning a Pro Tour is, like, a huge dream, right? And it's something that everybody aspires to do, and kind of achieving that is, it is a bit surreal. But, especially for me, it was kind of still very early in my career, so I wonder if I didn't savor it as much as I would if I, like, won now. And maybe I'm going to win this Arena tournament coming up.
Yeah, it's possible.
Maybe I won't, you know? I don't know. I have a pretty good feeling about it, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see if, hopefully this podcast ages well rather than poorly.
One question about the Vulcan thing. So I always thought, like, it's good to be not emotional, but I guess when you're outside of the game, because there's this thing that motivates, like, this passion, this human passion that motivates some people to, like, playtest harder or whatever, right? So they they can't be emotionless about outside of the process, right? They have to really want to win.
Oh, yeah. You can't be an unemotional Magic player. You have to want it. Otherwise, you're not going to put enough of yourself in it. You know, what some people call heart, right?
Yeah.
Oh, he's... Reed Duke's got the most heart, you know? Or, like, what commentators like to say, oh, he just wanted it more. He just wanted it more. It's like, well, there's a lot of people who wanted it, I'll tell you that. But, you know, it's a lot of times the lines that come out, you know, as the narratives are really just like, kids never stop buying lottery tickets. I was down to my last dollar, and then I finally bought a lottery ticket, and that one finally won after buying thousands and thousands, and that's going to happen to you if you don't give up. So there's no, you know, not everybody's going to get there. It's like, you know, and yeah, I mean, I think, in fact, a lot of the habits mentally of that type of, like, heart of stone is not healthy for your general life. And it's not good, I think, for pushing yourself to do better at Magic. It's good in the game of Magic, but I think after the game's over, you need to process those emotions. It's because, you know, you, other than maybe Ben Stark, we're all humans and we have emotions, and if you just push them aside, they're going to pop up at some point, which I think is why people are often super salty after they lose, or, you know, have these tantrums and stuff, or it's, you know, it's them processing their emotions in a toxic way. And instead, you should understand them yourself, you know, and be forgiving with yourself. You know, you're, again, I've tweeted this, but you're not your results at a Magic tournament, right? That even if you do poorly, that doesn't mean you're a failure or anything like that. It just means that your tournament didn't go well for whatever reasons. And all you could do is try better next time and hope that it works out. But I think a lot of these emotions are harmful while you're in the game of Magic. You, in fact, want to abuse your opponent's emotions to get information from them or to make them fall into traps. For example, when somebody thinks that, you know, is playing too scared or is playing, you know, not scared enough, they can see, oh, I can win if I just attack with everything and they don't have it. I've got this. And they don't play around that out that you could have, right? Similarly, that they're too scared to make that attack into your card, and kind of you have to judge what's correct to do, and it's, you know, it's not easy. You just gotta figure out what the mathematically correct play is, or if you get some kind of read from your opponent, go with that. But
anyway, let's answer a fun question. Someone's asking you what you think the difference between you and, I think it was, the average day two grinder at a GP. I believe that was the question.
So I think we've kind of discussed this on a previous episode when, you know, for example, I'd say the average day two competitor at GEP makes bleeding noises and has a thick coat of wool, you know, whereas I've got, you know, the lion versus sheep. I mean, from more of a Magic standpoint, it's hard to say. Like, it's not like, it's less one giant thing and more a thousand small things. Like, Magic, you know, has diminishing returns is how good you get. Some people like to say that it's very, you know, there's been discussion on Twitter about how skill-intensive is Magic.
And, you know, oh, yeah. Okay, we can talk about that also.
And, you know, for instance, that a computer program was shown, Magic is the only game that played the way people play it in real life, that a computer program can be put into a spot where it cannot solve what the optimal play is. And, you know, that's not in all situations. Often, you know, it's very simple when your opponents have three optimal plays to lightning bolt them to death when they have no cards in their hand or whatever.
Right.
But there are situations that you can come up with where the computer can't solve it. Some people are arguing that that means Magic's the most complex game, and other people argue that doesn't matter the fringe cases. What matters is the average case. Like, most of the time is Magic the hardest versus most of the time in other games. I'm not really going to get into that. I mean,
Sad Black was like, not close. It's not the most complicated game. Not close.
I mean, it's a very complicated game, but is it the most complicated? I don't know. I think anybody who can claim to know without actually being an expert in studying various games, you know, I put in too much time into becoming good at Magic and doing other things compared to deciding, like, judging how each game is complex and judging them against each other. I didn't write any papers on that, I'll say. But what we can say is that, like, Magic clearly is very difficult to a game. You know, there are spots where it's actually impossible for a computer to determine what the best play is. So, as a human who, you know, doesn't have the brute force strength of a computer, it's very hard to come up with the right play in certain scenarios. However, does that difficulty actually translate into getting more wins? And the answer is sometimes, but not that often. Often, you know, you're trying the obvious play and the tricky superior play are like, you know, one of your 99% to win, one your 99.1% to win.
Right, right. I think you mentioned this before.
We mentioned this before, and so it's incredibly hard to find that 99.1% play compared to the 99% play, but it gives you such a small improvement. You know, there's a third play, and that's the 25% play. And finding the 99% play over the 25% play is, I wouldn't say trivial, but it's a lot easier than finding the 99.1% play. And you get a huge increase in how much more you win. So, you know, the GP grinders, right, the day two competitors, they're almost always finding the 99% play. Occasionally they'll find the 99.1% play. Occasionally they'll miss the 99% play and find the 25% play. I think the pros will do the 25% play less, but probably not that much less compared to the other players, but they will find the 99.1% play will be the most common play they make. And then the 99% play, it's possible they might even find do the 25% over the 99% because they just like have some brain fart or something, you know, they make a horrible error rather than a small error. But you can see that even though it's way harder to find that play and the pros are doing that, it's not actually translating into much more of a win percentage. I think I saw Zach Hill say something like Magic is, a lot of its success is in the fact that you go to a Grand Prix and the worst player in the room has no chance to win the tournament, but the top 100 players, 100th best player, has a very good chance, and kind of having the variance balanced that way, so that like the, you know, the first amount of Magic skill you have gives you a huge edge, and then after that, you know, as you say, diminishing returns. Like the first 100 hours you spend into Magic will improve you so much more than the most recent 100 hours I've done, for example, right? I doubt that I've gained 0.1 percentage points from my last 100 hours of work in Magic, whereas the first 100 hours I spent on Magic, I probably gained at least 20 percentage points, right? So it's that's kind of how it is. So if I had to, you know, if you look at the win percentages, someone who makes day two of a Grand Prix, well, their win percentage is probably like 55%, right? Because they're making day two, but like a pro has, you know, a 60-65% win rate. Like a good grinder is probably 60%, a pro 65%, let's say. And the gaps there between like how much harder it is to get those higher win percentages is huge. It's like each percent is a struggle, you know. So, and again, like we talked about in a previous episode, you kind of get the first 50% for free in some ways, right? So you have to look at like what percentage of games, the games that are within your control that you win, kind of.
Right, we talked about that.
Because like, you know, an average player wins 50% of the time. So if you're above average, you're winning 55%, that's great. And if someone's winning 60%, oh, it's only 5% more. But actually, you should compare it to 50%. It's twice as much, kind of, as the 55% player. I don't know if any of that makes sense and really answers the person's question, but hopefully it gets somewhere to the point of, I think that the top pros are really, really good. And, like, you know, there's some players who make plays that even I don't understand, and I would consider myself one of the top players.
And in the world.
In the world, yes. And I think there's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of small things, a lot of finding those 99.1s versus those 99s. And, you know, imagine you have 100 such decisions in a game over a course of a, you know, 16-round tournament. You can see how it adds up to a couple of rounds difference, right?
Right.
So
I'm going to offer my perspective, and
as a day two Grand Prix player,
I was going to say that I'm at worst a day two Grand Prix. I'm at worst an average grinder during my, I guess, my playing days. But
you've kind of been out of it for a while, though. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's, what have you done for me lately? It's been ages since you won the Arena Super Cup.
From my perspective, it does come from chess, though. Like I always thought I was much, as I got better, like one of the early stages is just reducing the amount of tactical errors or the amount of blunders I would make. I felt like people that were far worse than me were just more likely to just hang their pieces for free and stuff like that. And I feel like in Magic, the main reason I rated you so highly from the start, like before you even won anything, was based on everyone I've played. This is like as early as 2010 even. Based on everyone I played, I felt like your frequency of tactical blunders was the lowest out of everyone I played. And so, for example, even the GPU one, I mean, the guy, I think, forgot that one of your creatures could give haste to another creature. So I think, like, the average, for me, this is my perspective, the average GP competitor is more likely to make those type of errors in a higher frequency. And sometimes you just feel like they just give the game away. And when you put me in some spots, even slightly winning board positions, and I fear that I don't have confidence that I'm just going to be able to carry that small advantage to a win. Whereas, like, if I had a choice to put you in my seat, I'd be like far more confident that you're not going to do a game losing blunder. And I think that's what I think about comparing you to, let's say, the average player. I just see them make a lot more obvious blunders, and sometimes,
yeah. I mean, you know, talking about the obvious blunders, like the 25% placed, right? Definitely, the average day two competitors are making those way more than the pros are. One thing, though, I think that people don't realize is the pros still make those too, and often, you know, those are the mistakes that the average viewer of Magic is going to notice versus the mistakes where they make the 99% instead of the 99.1, which is, you know, the pros are going to notice those mistakes when they're watching. But you don't, and so often I find Magic players are very judgmental. They'll watch a broadcast and be like, this a pro makes a 25% thing, and they're, oh, that guy's awful, he's so bad, or, you know, even worse, oh, you know, she's so bad, all women are bad at Magic, look at this one play. It's like, no, this is not how this works, you know. Everybody makes mistakes, including the pros. They're going to make those 25% plays. I know Paulo wrote an article about, like, what differentiates, like, what makes a great player great. You know, that was an interesting article he wrote back in the day when he wrote for Channel Fireball. He interviewed a bunch of pros and said, what, you know, what do they think they do better than other pros? Where are the gaps? And, you know, it's somewhat biased. And, it, you know, he interviewed me, for example, so I have my put my opinion there. But there's a lot of overlap with things. And, you know, Paulo's views, for example, that someone like, you know, he's someone who will make a boneheaded blunder a fair amount of the time. Maybe as much as like, you know, an SCG grinder. Maybe even, you know, let's say more often than some of these SCG grinders who are focused on, let's say, what they call the ABC magic. But he continually will find those higher level plays over and over again, comparatively. Partly because each play doesn't necessarily exist in a vacuum. People often think of it like there's this one spot, what do you do, right? And right. A lot of Magic, you know, there's the what's the play, like, articles and these things. And that kind of misses the fact that Magic is not just a tactical game, it's a strategic game. So you often want to have a plan for the whole game, not just that one moment. And a lot of times people will find the right play in that moment, but it's kind of by accident, which is why I find it more interesting to ask someone, like, why they made this play when I'm teaching someone, and understanding how they're thinking. Because what I want to encourage kind of in my students is I want them to be thinking about the whole game holistically, just like I like looking at Magic holistically, and that, like, how are they going to win the game? What is their plan for the game? And I want them to be making plays that align with that. For example, like, there's a situation where, like, you look and you can make an exchange of two creatures, right? And one creature's slightly better than the other. Your opponent's creature slightly better than yours. So you tactically look at it and it's like, well, their creature's slightly better. It makes sense for me to trade it off, right?
Right.
But if you actually, like, look at what your game plan is, your game plan, let's say, is to play, like, a whole bunch of Anthem effects or something, right? So actually having more creatures in play, like, benefits you, even if you have to take some damage to the point where you, like, get to play two Anthems, suddenly your creatures all trade up from their creatures, right? So, like, actually trading off there, even though in the, like, if you just take a snapshot of that, it looks like it's the right play. But if you think of the game and the match and your strategy as a whole, it's the wrong play. Kind of understanding that, I think, is one thing that great players do better than lower level players. I think for coming from a chess background, it's easier to understand that. The difference between tactics and strategy. That, you know, it's basically you focus on winning the war rather than the battle. And, you know, I think that, like, small things, especially, like, in Limited, of just trading off creatures or not trading off creatures is a huge thing that can have, you know, more advantages and disadvantages. Like, do you want to trade 3 damage? You get to do 3 damage to your opponent, and they get to do 1 damage to you. Is that a good thing that you want to happen? Well, usually, yes, right? You're winning that race. But your opponent's deck is full of burn spells and active treason effects, and your deck is full of card draw and, like, you know,
right,
big creatures or whatever. You're going to eventually grind out your opponent, right? So it's actually better for you to not exchange, because while you're getting a favorable exchange, it increases, like, the variance there that, like, you're going to lose to them having, you know, a draw with a bunch of active treasons and lightning bolts. Where if you just stay back, all their cards lose in value with, you know, your cards are not any better with them at 7 life and you at 13 compared to both of you at 20. Whereas their cards are a lot better with you at 13 life and them at 7 than 20.
I love this bit.
So, you know, you have to understand that in the game and your strategy as a whole. It's kind of, you know, your sensei, Mike Flores, wrote a quintessential Magic reading article, you know, from back in the day when people would write strategy articles, Who's the Beatdown? That, you know, it's kind of mostly understood by everybody who plays competitive Magic. But a lot of the time, I think people are not understanding it, and that's what, like, sideboard guides often give you, you know? It's like, look, this is how you sideboard this matchup. And then it's kind of obvious. Well, you know, we're bringing in all this removal and Chandra or whatever. You're probably planning to play a grindy game versus, like, hey, you know, you're cutting all your heavy things for more cheap creatures or whatever. You're probably trying to be more aggressive, more lean to the ground. It's complicated. There's no quick fix, which is what people are trying to sell. You know, they're trying to sell quick fixes, and sometimes it works for a tournament, you know. And certainly, again, like the lottery, you get to hear about all the winners. You get to hear about all the people who bought a deck guide for $3 and ended up winning a tournament. You don't hear about all the people who bought a deck guide for $3 and ended up scrubbing out. There's a lot more of them, I guarantee it.
Okay, let's finish with this fun topic. The Pinnacle odds for the Mythic Championship. I mean, who has buys? So, like, who are supposed to be?
So, the people who are ranked 16th, 18th, and 19th in the MPL race are all have buys, as well as Marcio. So Marcio Carvalho, William Huey Jensen, I'm blanking on it. I'm bad with coming up with people's names.
But
unannounced. But
there was, like,
there anyways. Jelger Vigersma, Hall of Famer. He works for Pinnacle Sports, and he every Magic tournament puts up the odds of different players winning the tournaments on Pinnacle, which you could bet on. I never do because I'm not allowed to. And I think KYT doesn't because he's just too poor for buying me food. But it is always interesting to see. I mean, he's associated with formerly the Pantheon, then Ultimate Guard Pro Team, kind of. And so his lines are slightly different. So it's Marcio Carvalho, Shota Yasuoka, Piotr Glogowski, and William Huey Jensen.
So they all have a bye today, too.
They all have a bye today, too. So the favorite, according to those lines, is William Huey Jensen. He's at 16-1. And then the other three with byes are all 19-1. Then, of the people with no byes, there's Reed Duke, Brad Nelson, and Chris Kvartek, all at 36-1. And it's nice to see Chris get kind of a little bit of a shout-out there in some ways. You know,
and Javier Dominguez, no?
Well, Javier is a master, but Chris is kind of a Kvartek. He's a challenger. He's the, you know, the highest listed challenger, right? He's above many MPL players. He's, you know, that's a lot of respect shown to him by those odds.
I think he's in that quick trailer beating you in a game.
pretty unlikely. I mean, he did beat me in one game, but I beat him in the other ones to win the match. But okay. He's a nice guy, and he's been crushing it this year, so I'm not surprised to see him do well. But and then there's the scrum of people with 41-1 odds, which includes BBD, Autumn Burchett, Paulo, John Emmanuel Dupraz, myself, Gregor Skowalski, Seth Manfield, Andrea Mingucci, Matthew Nass, Char Shenhar, Ken Yukihiro, and Dmitry Budakov, Stanislav Sipka, and Stephen Kroki. So you can see a few challengers in there, Budakov, Sipka, and Kroki. Personally, I think Sifka is probably underrated. I think he's really, really good. I would have him higher. I think I'm curious to see, in fact, what deck he's decided to bring, because that man is brilliant, and he works like a maniac. He's kind of a man of, you know, like in John Wick, a man of singular focus and talented will, or whatever.
Would you say the prize underrated or correctly rated now?
I mean, it's hard for me to say anyone's underrated if they're put in the same section as me, right? But I mean, I did call Sifka out. I think Dupraz is
where he's at.
Yeah, I think like I view this as the section of respect, but not heavy respect, right? It's the second best. Only three people have higher odds: Brad Reed and Javier and Chris Kartek. I guess so, four people. But
I would think you would have Javier over the people that are, no.
Yeah, I think I would have Javier higher, but I mean, you know, I'm not the odds maker.
Right.
It's just so, you know, I just find it fun to look at these things.
Yeah, let's go to the 61.
So 61. You want to read them out?
No. There's Bertud, Cuneo, Jessica Estefan, Eric Frolik, Christian Hauk, Ron Marnuza, John Rolfe, Carlos Romeo, Luis Salvato, Ray Sato, Li Shitian, Sigrist, Antonino De Rosa, we got Grensha, Kakume, Moutier, Tianfamun, Ganriel Nassif.
Yeah, it's written Ganriel Nassif. Obviously, we know it's Gabriel Nassif.
Alex Steyer, Ali Warfield.
And that's it.
And then.
So that's. A lot of people you can see with 61-1, which means that since there's 68 people in the tournament, 61-1 means that they're more likely than average to win the tournament.
I want to just jump straight to the next group, though.
You want to?
Well, the level of disrespect.
The first person in the next group.
The level of disrespect.
Ben Stark.
At 81.
So, no disrespect meant, though I guess normally when you say this, you end up disrespecting the person. But I don't know who Alexander Steyer is. I just know that he's got a great first name, so I guess maybe that's why he got 61-1, whereas Ben Stark got 81-1. But 81-1 is just like, Ben Stark is, by these odds, is a significant underdog compared to the average competitor in this tournament to win the tournament.
Is he the only MPL member at that?
No. There's at least one MPL member worse.
Okay.
I mean, we can go through basically everybody else is at 80 who in the tournament is 81-1, except for Savic and Chris Pakula, who are both 101-1. So it's a nice little dagger to Pakula as well.
That is a huge dagger, because Savic is probably not going to play again, right? I guess.
No, well, Savic is going to show up.
Oh, he's going
to
show up?
Yeah, he always shows up to the arena once.
Okay.
It's, in fact, in his contract that he has to show up to the arena once. And for 7,500 US minimum.
For him to for Pakula's.
But yeah, Chris Pakula and Savic, both there. I mean, it's interesting, you know, I definitely feel like, as much as we troll and disrespect Ben Stark, this is even more disrespectful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
so
we just joke about it.
Yeah, we joke about it, but we have a lot of love. This is like, you know, they're literally putting their money where our mouth is.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's true there's no limit in this tournament, but actually, you know, again, we talked about this, but I think Ben Stark is overrated for limited, but underrated for constructed. Though sometimes he proves me wrong by playing Weaselback Red Cap in his deck. So that could be why he's so lowly rated. But, you know, again, these are not at people's actual odds or just those set by these bookies, but it's always, I always enjoy looking at them and then either being tilted or not tilted. This time, my odds are reasonable enough that I'm not tilted about it.
I'm going to give a quick shout out to people listening to Isaac Krut. He was on the First Strike show. Comes from, I believe, Russia. And
he's Canadian now, though.
Canadian now. Qualified, well, obviously through the arena qualifier. But David Ruth thinks this kid has a lot of promise. So I don't know the rest of the, most of the people at 81 to 1, but he's someone to watch.
Yeah, he looks like he's as likely as Ben Stark to win the tournament. So. But and significantly more likely than Chris Bakula, we should mention.
I wonder if it's an inside joke, but no.
Oh, I think it is a bit of an inside joke. I don't think that many people actually bet on these lines, so a lot of it, I think, is just, like, Kai and Yelger just poking fun at their friends, or...
Yeah, because they usually put a cap on how much you can bet on these, so they could afford to do these daggers.
Yeah. I mean, I remember once, for example, Jacob Wilson was testing with the Yelger's group, right? And he was like 15 to 1 to top 8 the Pro Tour or something, I don't know. And then he was like 36 to 1 the next Pro Tour when he was working with our group, which had actually had a better track record in terms of putting people in the top 8s. And it's just, you know, it's just fairly arbitrary, but it is funny to look and see that the Ben Stark disrespect is real, and I'm looking for him to put up a good finish to shut down those haters, including us, you know?
So it's going to be what? Is it the same? Like it's 32 MPL and what? 32 or 36?
36 non-MPL. So it's 68 players altogether. 32 are MPL, four of which are automatically into day two, right? And then 28 plus 36 in day one. So 64 people in day one battling out.
How many arena championships have there been?
There's been two arena Mythic Championships before. The previous one won by Javier, and the one before that by, I think the
Reclamation guy?
The Reclamation guy? You can't even remember his name?
They don't do enough branding, man. I don't think he's known as the Reclamation guy.
That guy who opted and peeled off. No, no. I mean, come on. You can't. I'll give you a hint. He's from Argentina.
I don't know where he's from. What? I have no idea.
He didn't just play Reclamation. He played Nexus of Fate 2.
Yeah.
He defeated Brad Nelson in the finals. He's he's qualified for Worlds via winning his event.
I have no idea.
Wow. So much disrespect. How can you not know what his name is? You really don't know?
I have no idea what his name is.
See, it's just proof that Wizards is just not doing a good enough job with their promotion when you don't know Lavunga on Twitter. Also, Lavunga on MTGA. Lavunga 21 on MTGO.
Because I find that odds interesting, the last one, the winning group, where the MPL is a favorite, a decent favorite over non-MPL to win.
His name, by the way... Matthias Leveranto.
Yes. Because I think the non-MPL has a few good players that can definitely have a fighting chance to win it all. So.
Yeah, I mean...
But again, MPL will have buys. That's the problem.
Yeah, well, four of them have buys. Yeah. Which basically, like, since half the field makes day two, there's eight more challengers on day one than MPL, that kind of means, like, on average, four of those would make day two, which would even out with the MPL players in day two, right? I think if everybody was of equal skill, you would expect it to be a 50-50 between MPL and non-MPL winning the tournament. However, I don't think that's the case. I think the MPL are significantly more skilled. You know, not to take away from anybody else, but there's a reason they're in the MPL. If you've looked at most of the tops of a lot of these tournaments, you know, where there's even the paper tournaments, there's been a lot of MPL players kind of crushing them. You see a lot of the same names, and that's because, you know, variance exists, but the top players is still, somebody from the top group of players is usually going to win. So I'm going to predict that an MPL player is going to win this tournament. In fact, maybe one in this very room right now.
Hey, what's up, Ben?
Yeah, we're joined here by Ben Stark. How's it going? I do not understand. Where are the draft going-ons? You promised me a draft.
All right, let's call it a show. Let's call it a show. Thanks for everyone's support for the last episode, especially. And, you know, we'll do a show once Alex gets back, and hopefully he'll be a champion. And
yeah, hopefully with 50% nonsense more next time, because I felt like you tricked me into too much strategic content.
No, I think people can go back to listen to that. It was minimal leading this time. Minimal hand-holding towards the strategy. Yeah. All right. Love you all, and talk to you on Twitter.
Love some of you.
Talk to you on Twitter.
Talk to some of you on Twitter.
Ciao.
Peace.